Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I'm your host and lovelorn radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Advice from the Lovelorn Show. And before Rick gets the chance to interject, I'm going to go ahead and tell our radio audience. We scheduled this show. We recorded this show on Valentine's Day. And the sad thing was, as we went around the studio...
We're all here.
Every one of us.
And we record at the prime dinner hour. Yeah,
that's right. We, in fact, had absolutely no conflicts as a crew on Valentine's Day, which sort of tells you the state of our love life. Now, I will point out...
Well, and the funny thing is, two-thirds of us, better half, left us this week.
Yes, yes. Rick and I are both batching it this week. Shelley, meanwhile, has apparently... The husband's there, but...
I have a nine-year-old.
Yeah. There's no spark tonight, put it that way. But here we are together to give you the advice from the Lovelorn Show. With me, of course, as always, to debate this and any other topic that comes to her mind from the University of Kentucky, Physician Assistant Program Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And here to explain to you how to contact us on the web without using a dating service. You can actually get straight through to us, and you do not have to insert your profile or whether you like long walks or not. You can go straight to us, the Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure at the University of Kentucky, Rick Phillips. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Tony. Is this the show where you and I have to really like kind of like each other?
You know, we are, given the fact that neither one of us has a spouse this week, Rick and I have decided to bury the hatchet, and we, in fact, will probably wind up going to dinner or something like that together. And it's a bromance. It's a mandate.
You're going to be those guys.
The thing is...
Hey, buddy.
We're going to dinner to eat because we're both hungry, yeah, and neither of our wives are at home.
That's right. I've microwaved everything in the house, including the cat.
Oh, my goodness. And if you want more and more and more of this, you can find the audio of it at WMKY.org. That's Moorhead State Public Radio's website. It's there with a list of all the most recent shows, and there's a link to the audio for those shows. So certainly download them, listen to them. They're there for your listening pleasure. After that, jump over to Facebook, facebook.com/HMRadioShow. That's a fan page devoted just to this radio show. That's your chance to interact, leave some feedback, leave a show topic, ask a question, look at some of the fun facts that Tony posts up there from time to time. It's all there for you to be interacting with the show. It is a two-way communication, so don't be surprised if you don't get a response from one of us back. Again, let us know. That's the place to go. Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Vaccination League, back for the second week in a row, reminding you nothing says I love you like avoiding the flu. Laid it up on the spot, but the point is from the Vaccination League, I believe at this point, and Shelley, you tell me what you think. I believe at this point it is too late to get your flu vaccine. By the time our radio fans hear this on February 24th, 25th, that's pretty far into the flu season.
Yeah, probably, because it would take another couple weeks to take effect at least.
Yeah, so you'd be looking at mid-March, and again, we can't predict the weather. We can't predict when this flu epidemic is going to end, but we think that it would probably be pretty close. I think at that point, there is not so much point. However, there still is this 2018... the general vaccination recommendations, and we feel that that's really an important thing. First of all, a new shingles vaccine. Zostavax was the old shingles vaccine. Zostavax, to be honest, was not a very good vaccine. It was expensive. The level of immunity you got was not very good. I just talked to one of my patients in the clinic the day before we recorded this, and he said his wife got the Zostavax, and within a couple of months had a case of the shingles, and it did not seem to help. Now, it may have sped the resolution up, but I don't know. They have a new vaccine called Shingrix. The difference between Shingrix and Zostavax, there's two. Number one, Shingrix has an immune-boosting chemical added to the vaccine. It appears to be safe. It appears to boost your response. That will make you more likely to have some muscle aches or a sore arm after you get the vaccine. Sorry about that. However, it will also make you less likely, noticeably, measurably less likely to get the shingles, which is a condition that, first of all, is the open sores are going to last for a week or so, and the pain from the damaged nerves can last a long time. So, yes, you will be more likely to have a sore arm, but the trade-off is you'll be less likely to get shingles. Two doses, 2 to 6 months apart to adults ages 50 and older. The FDA just approved Zostavax, just approved Shingrix. So we wanted to make sure that you were aware. The CDC Advisory Committee is now recommending 2 doses of Shingrix preferred over the old Zostavax. And even if you have had Zostavax, they're recommending it. So let's review those recommendations one more time. A dose every year of influenza vaccine. The tetanus shot, every 10 years on the 10s, 40, 50, 60, 70, and so forth. And again, if you've not had one in 5 years and you do something stupid, go to the emergency room, get you a tetanus shot. The tetanus, again, it grows in wounds that close over. So any type of puncture wound, anything from a bite, which leaves a puncture wound, to stepping on a nail. Rusty, clean, doesn't matter. If you have a puncture wound, you need a tetanus shot. And as you mentioned last time, Shelley, if you have a burn, that's important. You should, if you're an adult, you should get the pertussis, the whooping cough. It is partnered with the tetanus shot, so you can make one of your tetanus shots a whooping cough vaccine. And if you have a grandchild or a child coming into your house, an infant coming into your house, it would be good to get your booster before the infant comes, because whooping cough is a very bad thing for a infant child to contract. They also mentioned the HPV vaccine for women up to age 26, men up to age 21. Remember our two-stage pneumonia vaccine. The old Pneumovax, which is what we used to give, that's a good thing. Glad you got it. But there is a second one called Prevnar or PCV13. It adds to your protection against the germ that causes pneumonia. And they're recommending, again, that those be dosed about a year apart. If you've had one, get the other one. If you haven't had either one, get the Prevnar first, followed by the Pneumovax. That's our sponsor, Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Vaccination is like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. Now, we start off, actually, with an article about flu vaccine. This came from Reuters Health on February 7th. And this is a Japanese study. First of all, reminding you about the flu worldwide, affecting 3 to 5 million people, resulting in somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 deaths, according to the World Health Organization. In industrialized countries, that's a lot of people over age 65 who die. And that's the people, those and the very young children, are the ones we're trying to protect by doing a flu vaccine. Now, this Japanese study, they looked at people over age 65. Unvaccinated women who regularly participated in two or more social activities were twice as likely to report a flu infection as those who didn't participate in such activities. So the Japanese study holds true for the American population, if you have a senior citizen, a mother, a grandmother, an aged aunt, or whatever, and this person likes to go out and do social activities, they're going to be exposed to the flu virus, they're vaccinated, they're half as likely to actually catch the flu.
Do you think it's because women may tend to be more hands-on with food and food stuff, or people, children, you know, more likely to come in contact with it?
Yeah, there's something about it. Two things. One is, again, if you did get the flu shot, no additional risk. If you didn't and you were socially active, twice as likely. Men, didn't matter. Men, I mean, let's face it. If you sit in the chair and watch the football game, or if you're over there anxiously waiting for the social event to be over, the practice to end, or the mixture to end, and so forth, then nothing. But apparently, women are more interactive, is their theory. Now, maybe this is just a fluke, but if women are, in fact, more interactive, as you mentioned, you know, preparing food, talking to each other, doing things like that. For whatever reason. Now, that doesn't mean that men shouldn't get the flu shot. This is just one study. But it echoes the point that if you are out in society, it is a good idea to get a flu shot. Remember this for next year. More than 12,000 men, 14,000 women over age 65. And as I mentioned, men, it didn't matter whether you were socially active or not, but because apparently we men, even when we're socially active, are not truly socially active. We'll go. We'll show up, but we'll sit in the corner and avoid viruses. Whereas women, they get out, they talk to each other, they touch each other, they do all this stuff, and then they get the flu. They need the flu vaccine.
Why don't you take a crack at the researcher's name?
Now she's just messing
just
with
me. Just for the fun of it.
Shobagawa. Okay. And that is yeah. I mean, that's
how
the
way
it is
spelled. And how would we know if it's wrong?
What's that?
How would we know if it's wrong?
Well, if Dr. Shobagawa would call us, Dr. Yugo Shobagawa of Niigata University in Niigata, Japan. Now, somebody who's actually from Japan or knows Japanese, tell us how badly we scored on that.
I think you did a good job. I think you did a good job.
Well, the consonants and the vowels lined up, and I just said what was printed there. Next up, something that puzzled me, Rick.
Really?
Yes.
Something puzzled you?
Published online February 1st in the journal Obesity. Amy Gorin, she's at University of Connecticut, and they looked, this was a Weight Watchers study, funded by Weight Watchers. They had 130 overweight or obese cohabiting couples. They had to be 25 to 75 years old, had to have a body mass index of 27 to 40, and that's big bone women and men. The most of them were big bone women. But they also included their spouses. They said, all right, if you are a person, ages 25 to 75, and you have someone living with you, 93% married for same-sex relationships, and 68% of the people who joined the study were women, 68% of them. They said, if someone is living with you, we're not going to invite them to do the study, but we're going to weigh them. So half these 130 people got Weight Watchers. Half of them got just some cards and information about how to lose weight. 37% attended one or more in-person meetings. They averaged, they went to 12 meetings. The Weight Watchers group, at 3 months, lost 7.5 pounds versus 4 pounds in the group that just got cards. Their untreated spouses lost 3 pounds, 1.5% of their weight. 6 months, Weight Watchers, the control group caught up. Weight Watchers group lost 9.5. The group that just got the cards, 6.8 pounds. The spouses continued their downward trend. They lost 4 pounds. And a third of the spouses. This is where it gets. So the Weight Watchers was not more effective than just simple information. Meanwhile, a third of the spouses dropped 3% of their weight, which is the minimum amount, according to the American Heart Association, to achieve benefit. Now, again, you're talking about a 6-pound weight loss for a 200-pound person. This is not the kind of thing where you celebrate. I mean, you could put that right back on with a piece of cake.
So or it's two.
So it's not a celebratory thing, but still it's an okay thing. So what we're going to do is take a break, and we're going to celebrate the weight loss we had in our first fractional portion. We're going to come back with our second fractional portion listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Advice from the Love Lauren Show.
Whatever we say, do the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. If you
Tony,
don't,
did you get your wife a Valentine's Day gift?
If you don't love your spouse, if you do not treat your spouse with respect, you will end up like us on Valentine's Day. You will have your own radio show.
Bitter and alone.
Absolutely right. Our sponsor for the second time, Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Let's go over those again. What vaccinations should an adult have? According to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, this is a special group within the CDC. They say an adult should have flu shot every year. Too late this year, get it next year. They should have tetanus every 10 years, unless you do something stupid, you go to the emergency room, and if it's been more than 5 years, you get your booster then. They should have one of those tetanus boosters, should also include the acellular pertussis vaccine. That's the whooping cough vaccine. It's called a Tdap. So if you haven't had it, and particularly if you've got children, infants coming to the house, you should get that. Indicate that for shingles, people over age 50 need to get the Shingrix vaccine, two doses of Shingrix, 2 to 6 months apart. For pneumonia, it is a two-stage procedure as well. First, the Prevnar, and then the old Pneumovax. If you've already had the old Pneumovax, you had one pneumonia shot. There is a second that is different, and those are recommended 1 year apart. HPV for women up to age 26, HPV for men up to age 21. And those are the vaccines that they recommend for people at average risk. Now, if there is a mumps, measles, or rubella outbreak in your region, then they may recommend a booster, but that is not to be done. That booster is not to be done routinely unless there is, in fact, an outbreak. That's our sponsor, the Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. And remember, the best way to say I love you is to not spread the flu.
That's new.
I changed it.
Yeah, that's new. Mm-hmm. I'm working with it. I have that flexibility there.
Can you do something different that actually sounds good?
Our profession, our professional level, you can wing it.
After 15 years, Tony, I think we should quit calling should it winging it.
It's pretty much what we do every weekend.
It'll never fly.
Okay, so just a reminder from last time. I don't want to go over this again, but very simply, Weight Watchers sponsored a study. Married couples, mostly, 93%, but people living together. If one of them did Weight Watchers, they lost some weight, but not more than people who just got advice on weight loss. And I think that was disappointing. Basically, if you pay attention to weight, you will lose weight. On the other hand, the spouses wound up losing weight as well. They got no intervention, no information, no Weight Watchers, but at 6 months, they had dropped 3% of their body weight, which, again, not much, but it did go in the right direction. Their conclusions on that are quite simply, you know, we are, as we've talked many times, interconnected. If our spouse does something unhealthy, we are more likely to do something unhealthy. And likewise, if they do something healthy, that may benefit. So it may be the best way to help your spouse to a healthy lifestyle is to actually to improve your own health. We don't know that because none of us is with our spouses right now. But we suspect that could be true. And here's how we could guess. You can chime in.
I was just thinking of all the unhealthy things my guys are probably doing right now.
Well, you're here. I mean, let's face it, recording a radio show on Valentine's Day is not the healthiest thing.
No, but, you know, at home eating candy.
But here we are.
Would not be healthy either, so.
Yeah.
So here we are, just, you know.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think I basically blew you off, Rick, but I did not do a thing for my wife for Valentine's Day. I freely confess. I've got, at the time we're recording this, it's the evening of Valentine's Day. I suppose before the clock strikes midnight.
Is she in a different time zone or something?
To redeem myself. She's in Central Time, so before the clock strikes 1 a.m., I may be able to save myself if I can get rid of the ghost of Christmas yet to come and actually do something. So there's that. You, meanwhile, your wife is in the Eastern Time Zone, so you've only got to midnight.
I've already done something. She didn't leave until today.
Oh, so.
She left me on Valentine's Day.
So well, you gave her a gift and she left.
I was going to say, whatever you did, apparently it didn't work too well.
I gave her a gift and she engaged a plane ticket.
And so in that sense, wasn't that the gift? You're holding, the fort is being held down.
That's correct.
Make sure that everybody's.
It's my job is to make sure that by the time she gets home at the end of Sunday, that none of the animals that we take care of have died.
Keep the animals alive and that's your manly job. And I feel the same way.
But they're actually, once I turned 25, there was a new requirement added to that. So I have to make sure the house doesn't burn down.
Oh. So it's like multitasking.
There's a story there, yeah.
I mean, just, you know, that's what comes with more responsibility.
Grown up, Rick. Suddenly, and you're saying, look, honey, I can't do everything. And Shelly, see, I mean, in addition to pets, Shelly has a son.
Yes.
And that complicates things.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. See, my wife used my children to check up on me. She'll use them to make sure I'm doing okay.
Well, the thing is, the dog's not going to say anything if I don't quite get the job done. I mean, you know, as long as the dog's still alive, everything's good. Your son, you know.
He will tell. He is very. He will throw either of us under the bus at the first opportunity.
There you go.
Unashamedly.
Okay. So health habits, I think we said good health habits would be a good idea, but we're not sure because none of us has a spouse right now to practice on. Moving on, because I have nothing else to say on that, New York Times on February 6th, reported in the journal Nature Communications, a brain implant noticeably boosted memory in its first serious test run. Improved word recall by 15%. That is, they gave them, they gave the people a bunch of words to recall. These were, by the way, people who were receiving, this is one of their favorite things to do is when they're mapping out seizures. They have electrodes in the brain anyway. And they say, well, while we've got the electrodes in the brain anyway, let's, maybe we should just check to see if we can do something other than just get information from them. Perhaps we can, in fact, use them sort of like a pacemaker to boost the brain's activity. So they did that. They said, now, wait a second. Let's be careful here. The potential for misuse of this is big. And they said a 15% increase in memory is, it's about the amount that Alzheimer's disease takes over 2.5 years, but it's not that large amount. And I'm thinking, if I could remember 15% more, that would be a big deal.
That would be a big deal.
But isn't the whole thing with 15%, isn't that not enough change to really, I mean, you have to wonder if that's really accurate. I mean, you can either, to me, you should be able to increase your memory or not. Not say, okay, I remember one out of every 15 words more now.
No, I understand what you're saying.
Actually, that's wrong. 15 out of 100, but, yeah. You know, 1 out of 6.
Yeah. So this guy's name is Edward Chang, University of California, San Francisco. 25 people with epilepsy being evaluated for an operation. They, again, put the electrodes in the brain. And then they determine their patterns for each person's high-functioning state when memory storage worked well in the brain and low-functioning mode when it did not. The low-functioning mode, we call that the RIC mode. Where you don't, your brain just does not work well, and then they ask patients to memorize.
Is that like when you're awake?
No, you know, and let me just right now publicly apologize to you because I said Valentine's Day I was going to be nice, and then I went after you with that RIC mode.
Trust me, brain your printer will thing. Never work again.
RIC has the ability apparently to make my computer break down, and so I need to be Here's nice
the
anyway.
Thing.
But it's Valentine's
Here's
Day.
Here's the thing: so you're just not going to know
extra nice
if it was me or not.
Happens every day. I figure you've got something better to do. All right, cognitive scientists use this to give memory tests and take recordings. And again, they had the high-functioning, low-functioning state. They did a variety of tests repeatedly, recalling different words during each test. They did about 15% better. One participant says, I enjoyed the test, but I couldn't tell whether the stimulation was on or off. That is, it is not like you feel a super powerful surge of brain. So, to Rick's point, you know, you may be able to remember some more words with these implants. I really believe, you know, we've talked about magnetic stimulation of the brain. We have those gamers' helmets that you can buy online for $300. I believe that that people will try this. I do not think that – I'm not worried that people are going to abuse brain implants, though. Of all the things people are going to abuse, brain implants, low on the list. Darn those kids and their brain implants, you know. You leave them alone for a minute, and they've got a brain implant. That's not practical. And I don't know.
What if you have a photographic memory? How's that going to help? What if I don't remember words? What if I remember pictures?
Well, depending on the level of stimulation. I mean, the idea behind no. I think the magnetic game helmets, I think are also about memory. Because, you know, you're supposed to be able to remember more quickly the layout of the game and where the objects or the enemies are or things like that. So I believe that those are also memory. I do not believe that they make you think faster. I've not seen anything that says, all right, you can solve mathematical problems, you know, in half the time or anything like that. I think it's all memory.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Memory is a great thing, but.
Who needs memory when you got a smartphone?
Well. Now, that's not really true because there's some things you do have to remember, but you're right.
Or you put the smartphone.
You're right. There are things that you can look up now with great ease, but you do have to remember how to use your smartphone. And, you know, that can be difficult.
Yeah.
Do you know how to take a screenshot on your phone?
No.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you like to have more memory? To be able
to remember how to take a screenshot?
Yeah, right.
See, I can work around that. I don't necessarily need a screenshot.
Why not? What if your phone does something silly and you need help? Somebody, you know, shouldn't you screenshot it and send it to them so they can help you?
Well, that would be your way to fix things. See, I just get upset and walk away.
Okay, I'm leading oars to water right now. That's all. I just need you to get there.
Okay. You know, if I had a brain implant, I would remember why I did not want
you
to
had
be
me up until implant.
The Valentine's Day show with you anyway. I mean, this is, you know, so I apologize to you because it's Valentine's Day and I thought we should be nice because we're going to go out to eat together and it looks like we're just going to fight through the meal. Because you're just such a jerk.
One happy couple.
With your
at Oscar and Felix.
Can I be Oscar?
You can be whoever you want to be.
I don't know. All right. But let's talk
what were
about
you talking about again?
Smartphones.
No, so, remember, Tony, you were talking about memory.
I
implants.
Know, but I moved on because I forgot. In all seriousness, this was back in January. It's the issue of Journal of Hospital Medicine. And I just like this. This was a very simple thing to do. They were looking at this was in South Australia. They were people admitted by surgery doctors for operations, and they got 221 of them, and they just looked to see if the people used a smartphone. Do you or do you not use a smartphone? And if they use a smartphone, 11% were observed using a smartphone. And of the ones using of all patients, 11% were using a smartphone. But of the ones who were discharged on post-op day one, immediately after their surgery, they were felt to be socially connected and well enough to go home. 23.5% of those were using a smartphone in the hospital. Those who were observed to be using a smartphone, another way to put this, over 5 times more likely to be discharged home on day one, and they were actually less likely to be readmitted. So now, first of all, there's a bunch of ways you can look at this study. It was just simply, were you using a smartphone? When did you go home? Did you come back in? And the answer is, if you use a smartphone, 5 times more likely to get home after one day rather than a prolonged stay in the hospital, and you were less likely to come back. So, first of all, this might be then the people who were more intelligent. They are more higher socioeconomic status. They had more money. They had a smartphone and were using it. It might be that they were more connected. You know, again, those men that didn't need the flu shot sat in the corner, didn't use their smartphones.
Well, it could be just a matter of resources, too. I mean, think about the patients in the hospital that are hardest to get home. You know, the ones that live alone, the ones that don't have resources, the ones that have issues with electricity or connectivity in general. You know, so it could just be simply they have phone, they have people to call.
Yeah.
They can access resources.
But and you can't, you know, we've talked about these observational studies. You can't simply give people smartphones and then send them home after surgery. That doesn't work that way. You can't use this to change behavior. On the other hand, we could use this to predict behavior. If this is true, then in a given situation where a person's health might be compromised, you know, for whatever reason, it will be an easy study to replicate. I would wonder, well, in fact, do people who use a smartphone, is there something that distinguishes them? Now, I believe in Australia, most people have one. You know, we looked at teenagers last week, and I believe that by sophomore year or junior year of high school, almost 90% of them already had a smartphone. And so in that case, it doesn't become a marker that they have a smartphone. What it says is if they don't, you're in serious trouble. These are very pathologic people if they don't have a smartphone in this day and age.
I don't know. The whole thing is intriguing. I mean, the thing is, having a smartphone and using a smartphone are two totally different things, right? So, you know, I see people that use their phone for phone calls, voicemails, and occasionally text messages. And then I see some people in the IT field that can take their smartphone and fix any computer problem they have because they're able to do Google searches right from it and find answers and solve problems. And, you know, me personally, the smartphone is an absolute minimum use device for things like that, just because at my age it's hard to read the screen, and you know, I don't carry around a mini laptop in my pocket. You know, it's still a regular size smartphone, and so the screen is not huge, and thus, you know, I can't do a lot on it, so I use it for bare minimum work. But I've seen people that are really, really smart with smartphones, and then I've seen people who take a smartphone and it's just about as good as a boat anchor.
I understand. The ones I know that are using it heavily. Now, again, they just observed them using it. They did not say the
see, I would judge them by how many apps they have loaded, and or maybe what apps. So do you have this many in this particular category? Do you have this many in productivity? Do you have this many in business and you know, activity? Or, you know, I would judge it based on how many apps you have and what the mix of apps are.
But you might – that might be exactly wrong. You have a smartphone that controls many items in your house or things like that. You have an app for that, but that does not make you more connected. It may be just the opposite. The ones who have a lot of social media on there, they have a bunch of friends who are going to come over and check up on them when they go home. So it may be, again, a measure of interconnectedness rather than a measure of intellect or technological ability.
Well, but I don't disagree. I mean, I think you're right. But to my point, then that they would have a lot of apps in the social category.
Right.
I mean, so I'm just saying you can look at a person's phone and look at their app mix and their app breakdown, and you can tell how they're using the phone.
Okay. Now, well, how they're using it, absolutely, because otherwise you won't have apps on the phone that you're not using for the most part.
Well, for the most
part. You're going to have them concentrated.
Right. I mean, you know, if a person, all they have is, you know, music and movies and, you know, Pandora and, you know, then you kind of know, okay, well, this is a person who likes entertainment.
Right.
But if you see a ton of, you know, like, do they have a VPN client loaded? Well, that means they're probably logging into their work and doing work.
I really do. Because, you know, we a couple of years ago, I still remember, on Valentine's Day or close to it, we presented some information from one of those online dating services that the single best question that determines compatibility is whether or not you like horror movies. It turns out that if you like scary movies, then the people you date should like them as well. Not simply because of the entertainment value, but there is a different type of person that likes to be scared or doesn't like to be scared, and they don't mix very well.
Right.
In this same way, could you look at somebody's apps and determine whether or not this is
they're
person
compatible?
For you? Yeah,
probably. Probably, and you and I have totally different apps.
We should cancel dinner. It's not going to work. It's just going to make things worse.
But I thought you were paying.
Yes, and so we should cancel dinner.
It looks like takeout for the odd couple.
That's right. You get your fries, I'll get my fries, we'll meet back together. Meanwhile, though, we're going to have to take yet another break and allow you a moment to recover your sanity because we're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Advice from the Lovelorn Show. We are reveling in the fact that none of us has anything to do on Valentine's Day night more than deliver Health Matters. This is not a measure of dedication. This is just sheerly nothing else to do on Valentine's Day. I'll let that sink in. What can you do to help us out? Send and give generously to Moorhead State Public Radio. Perhaps as we become more and more famous, we will attract groupies and actually have...
Groupies.
See, he's Listen, thinking groupies. I'm thinking paychecks.
Either way, attraction to other people is boosted. I mean, if you have money or you're famous, either one will work perfectly fine. Just saying that. Our sponsor for the final time, the Vaccination League. Don't be late. Vaccinate. Reminding you, nothing says I love you like avoiding the flu. We are talking about vaccination, and as we said, we believe that as of the time this show airs, it's really too late to get the flu vaccine for the 2017-2018 flu season. A severe flu season. Highest rate of hospitalizations in the history of recording hospitalizations from influenza. Numerous deaths among children, many of them healthy previously. And all around, a bad flu season. The flu vaccine was not as effective as we would hope. Mainly because of that H3N2 flu, or H2N3. But at any rate, it was not as effective as we had hoped, but it still was more effective than doing nothing. Meanwhile, year-round, wash your hands, and avoid people who are sick. Please don't bring your germs in, and please try to avoid those other people's germs. The other things we talked about, tetanus shot on the 10s, 30, 40, 50, 60, and 5 years if you've not had a tetanus shot and you do something silly that causes a puncture wound.
So do you just go to your family doctor and say, I need a tetanus shot?
Yes. In fact, that's exactly what I did when I turned 60.
Because I got a birthday ended in zero this year.
Okay. Yep. And the thing is, you go in and you say, you tell them that, and we celebrated the fact that I hadn't done anything stupid in over 5 years.
So do you think me and my doctor are going to celebrate because I need a tetanus shot?
I think that's, you know, Rick, it depends on how you phrase it. You know, if you go in and say, I need a tetanus shot, they'll just say, okay. But if you say, you know what? It has been over 5 years since I did anything stupid that resulted in an emergency room visit.
I'm really expecting that my currently listed family physician would know that already.
Rick and I recommend a tetanus shot. And
he's trying to avoid saying he's my family physician. and he should know well, how to have a good conversation.
Pretty much when he
not.
Does something stupid, because I'm there with him to do it. The other thing besides the tetanus shot, the acellular
just
pertussis.
Put it on YouTube next time.
That's Tdap. Those are recommended once as a booster for the whooping cough, and particularly, again, this pertussis affects infants. If there's an infant child coming to your house, do everyone a favor and get vaccinated. The shingles vaccine, a new form of shingles vaccine called Shingrix is out, and two doses, 2 to 6 months apart. It has what's called an adjuvant that stimulates your immune system. It produces a more robust immune response, which means that you will be more protected for a longer period of time than the old Zostavax, which will probably be right off into the sunset and not be used anymore. HPV vaccine, we do recommend this. The human papillomavirus is a nasty thing that causes, what are we thinking, 90% of cervical cancer, something along those lines. Also, has caused an outbreak of oral cancer among young people. And you can vaccinate for that, a very good idea, up to age 26 for females, up to age 21 for males. And then finally, there is a two-stage pneumonia vaccine. The old Pneumovax, if you've had it, well, then good for you. But there is a second one called Prevnar. And when we're talking about the pneumonia vaccine, if you have had a single pneumonia vaccine, there is a second one that is now recommended, and they should be given about a year apart. So talk to your doctor about your pneumonia vaccine status. That changed last year. The Shingrix vaccine is new this year. That is our sponsor, the Vaccination League. Now, a little bit of time left. We're going to talk about what's in your colon or your child's colon.
Do we have to?
Yes, because we're Health Matters and it's Valentine's Day.
So we're going to talk about the colon.
Colon problems. What better time? This was, in fact, there's a infectious disease thing that I follow called SIDRAP. It gives me updates on the flu and on other infectious disease matters. And they profiled a guy named Martin Blaser. Blaser is director of the Human Microbiome Program at NYU School of Medicine. And he was giving a talk at the University of Minnesota, which is where SIDRAP's headquartered. And he's written a book called Missing Microbes, How Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. His idea is that there is, although antibiotics are very useful in killing bacteria, but we have had this steady rise in our rates of diabetes, asthma, obesity, allergies, and he feels that it obviously parallels the antibiotic use, and perhaps there may be a cause. He is particularly interested in the antibiotic exposure in the early years of childhood, ages 0 to 3. According to the CDC, by the time U.S. children have reached age 2, they've already received almost 3 courses of antibiotics on the average. 3 courses of antibiotics in the first 2 years of life. Similar in Europe. In Pakistan, they've had nearly 10 courses of antibiotics by age 2. Finland, they looked at 15,000 kids who had allergies to cow's milk. The more antibiotics the children receive, the higher risk of having the allergy. Now, the problem with these observational studies is maybe receiving antibiotics led them to get allergies to cow's milk. Maybe these are just sick kids. They get more infections. They have more allergies. Their immune system just doesn't know what to do. That's possible. But a million people in Finland found the same thing about type 2 diabetes. And then in the United Kingdom, 10,000 children born in the early 1990s. a link to exposure to antibiotics in the first 6 months of life, and increased weight gain. Now, the weight gain, I think, is a pretty much a done deal. You know, we know for years farmers are giving antibiotics to livestock to fatten them up.
Bulk them up, yeah.
Yeah, so there's no doubt that there is some relationship between antibiotics and weight gain. But these other things, allergies and diabetes, asthma, and things like that, that's still speculative. And what got me was they're trying to nail this down. The last thing they say is, when Blazer looks at CDC map showing states in the southern United States have the highest rates of antibiotic use and the highest rates of obesity, he sees a correlation. Well, we live here.
Come to our hometown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it may very well be that our antibiotics led to obesity, but it's not like the landscape is pristine other than antibiotic. You say, here's a bunch of healthy people leading healthy lifestyles, except we use a lot of antibiotics, and that leads to obesity. We, especially in the mountains in eastern Kentucky, we love Mountain Dew. We adore it. We drink gallons of it. It is our favorite drink.
Donuts, cigarettes.
Yeah. We smoke cigarettes, which should keep our weight down. We love junk food. That's a good thing. And so to isolate that and say, well, antibiotics lead to weight gain. Again, I'm not disputing that they can lead to weight gain, but I think it is really simplification to say, all right, people in the South have higher use of antibiotics and higher weights.
I would agree. There's just medicine's messy. It can't be that simple.
But now let me go back and let me argue the other side of it. I'm right now putting together a history of smoking and health. That I'm going to present later on to a group of specialty of healthcare providers in a couple months. And the thing that struck me is doctors and researchers knew there was some link between cigarettes and lung cancer way back in the 1920s. And they saw how the more people smoked and the rates of smoking cigarettes starting with World War I, rose steadily all the way through the late 1960s, and the lung cancer rates grew as well. And it would seem to a modern observer, there's no doubt, if you set some fire to something, you put it in your mouth, you breathe it into your lungs, and you're doing that more and more and more, then that's causing the lung cancer. But as I look back over the articles, the scientific articles, the newspaper articles, and so forth, we had a great deal of trouble coming to grips with the fact that you can't set fire to things and breathe them in. And so if we were that, I'll say stupid, if we were that blissfully ignorant about the cause of lung cancer, and I know, even as I say this, there are some people out there listening who think, I don't know about that cigarettes and lung cancer thing. I believe it is fully possible to set fire to something, stick it in your mouth, and not have any problems.
Well, but Tony, I mean, that's, to some extent, you can. It's hard to argue when your grandfather lived to be 99 and he smoked like a chimney. I mean, the thing is, what I've always tried to explain that, look, different people have different genetic code, and the different genetic code behave differently when presented smoking, you know, or when they're presented what happens to your body via smoking. And so, you know, some people do have the ability. Now, they're rare. But they have the ability to smoke their whole life and live a long life and die of something else. That's just not the norm.
Yeah.
Right?
And what they're smoking, too.
Well, I mean, my grandfather lived 99. He smoked Camels.
With
no filter.
Let me tell you, I have seen that as well. I have also seen, and let me just tell you this, I also took care of a guy who was 90 years old. And back in World War II, he bailed out of a plane without a parachute. Now, he broke many, many bones doing this, but he bailed out of a plane without a parachute. You cannot use that one guy and say, well, gee, I guess parachutes really don't matter, because I know a guy who didn't have one, and he seems fine. He's 90 years old.
So. But I would argue, Tony, I think, you know of one guy in your lifetime that ever fell out of an airplane or jumped out of an airplane and survived without a parachute. You can talk to hundreds of people who know of that one grandfather that lived on, and had to have something to do with the fact that they were much harder workers than we were, that their bodies were in different shapes, that they ate different, their different intakes of food. I mean, there's all kinds of things, but there's lots of people who have that
And this was one of the reasons, you know, one of the reasons that the research was confusing at the time. There were different rates of lung cancer from one city to the next, and it did not seem to track with smoking. Maybe then air pollution caused lung cancer. And cigarettes, they're just another thing, but probably it's the air pollution. You read the headlines and you realize it took us 100 years conclusively to decide that cigarettes caused lung cancer. There certainly are other things. There certainly are exceptions. But there is no doubt as the rate of cigarette use rose, the lung cancer rates rose. There's also no doubt that as the rate of cigarette use fell, the lung cancer rates fell. There's no doubt about this. And yet it took us 100 years. So when we talk about antibiotics being linked, when we change the very germs that inhabit our colons, and something happens, again, I know this sounds mysterious to our listeners, but we are learning more and more about the effects of these antibiotics. And the message that I would recommend is just like with cigarettes, you don't do something if you suspect there might be a bad outcome unless it does a lot of good things. So if you need antibiotics, if your limb or life is threatened by an infectious agent, then you go in and you kill everything in sight and you will probably turn out better. However, if you have a sore ear or if you have a sore throat or your nose is running a little bit and you choose antibiotics, you may be doing yourself a big disservice. That's a that from SIDRAP. Again, the guy's name is Martin Blazer. We don't recommend books. The name of the book, in case you were wondering, Missing Microbes, How Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. But you can find this if you just search for antibiotics and adverse effects. You can see a lot of this. I just read about Carinibacterium possibly being related to the onset of colon cancer.
Isn't this why you really should, as we say all the time, consult your physician and, you know, talk to your doctor?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, your doctor really should help you take or not take something. Now, I think we all may say that maybe it's easy to prescribe. It's easy. Is it overprescribed?
Yeah, they are. And so I would say, you know, talk to your doctor, listen to your doctor about this. The problem is a person comes in and says, look, I just paid a large amount of money, took off work to see you, and I have a runny nose.
Yeah, I don't feel good. I'm busy. I've got kids to take care of. I'm taking care of ailing, sick parent. You can see how they're desperate to get anything that might help.
They are. And meanwhile, as a doctor, you are busier than ever before because of the silly electronic records we have that don't work. And so you wind up, you said, look, the easiest way to move on to the next patient is to give some antibiotics, and probably nothing will happen. As a doctor, I think that. My patient will be satisfied. I won't have to do all this explaining.
But you can do that once, but you don't do that for the same patient over and over and over.
No, but the thing is, I'm actually, you know, I'm trying more and more to try to set aside time not to do those things. I'm become convinced that it is very important that we minimize our use of antibiotics to those situations where it is clear that the antibiotic is going to produce a very important response. So if your nose is stopped up and your sinuses are congested, I really don't want to use that antibiotic. I will argue with you. I will struggle to avoid using that antibiotic because I think I am doing more harm to you in the long run. I won't be able to prove it maybe for 10 years, maybe 20. Mm-hmm. But at some point.
Once you write that antibiotic, it sort of sets that precedence, and they're going to expect it the next time they come in.
Remember last time I had this sinus thing? So we're asking our radio fans, you know, take a moment. And ask yourself, what would happen if I didn't get this antibiotic? Is this a life-threatening, limb-threatening problem? And if not, then it may very well be the best course of action for you is to wait.
I tell you, I've always tried to take as little medicine as possible theory in life, right? You know, it'd be so easy as you get older and you start feeling these little aches and pains. It's so easy just to start swallowing the ibuprofen or... I really try not to do it because it just seems like our bodies were made to take care of themselves. And there, obviously there's times where you have to help that or there's things that come up. But if you can do without it, you should.
We have a mechanism. we now understand that there are germs we did not know existed and that they interact with our body in ways we did not understand. Now, we're working out the details, but while we work out the details, it makes sense not to mess with those germs, not to poke them, unless there is a clear indication and a clear benefit to be obtained. And in the case of minor ear infections, sinus infections, a sore throat, there may not be that benefit. Speaking of no benefit, maybe it's time to get Health Matters off the air.
So do we have to do the same one again?
I love this one. It's perfect for Valentine's
Day. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks to our show. Thank you for listening to our show, and remember these wise words from Rick Phillips.
Health Matters works for men with radio dysfunction by increasing blood flow to the ears so you can get and keep an ear action hard enough for radio listening.
Individual results may vary. It's been proven to help guys with all degrees of radio dysfunction. Health Matters usually starts to work within 30 to 60 minutes, and you only take it when you need it.
Health Matters works only when you are listening to radios. You may take it up to 4 hours before radio activity, so don't worry. There's no need to rush.
After our show, your ear action should go away. In the rare event of an ear action lasting through Bluegrass Railroad, seek immediate medical help to avoid long-term injury.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down.
I notice how you don't have to say anything.
I know. Get out this week. Make a healthy change in your life. And please, find someone to love so that you don't turn out like the Health Matters cast and crew. And tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.